UFOs? Are they aliens? Government secret projects? The imaginings of disturbed individuals? Or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters. Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And there are certain guests who become your favorite over the years, and we certainly have one of those today. And we're going to talk to him kind of about the state of ufology, and I can't think of a better person than Peter Robbins. He is one of America's best known and most respected UFO investigative writers, and he's been involved in this field for more than 30 plus years. He's been a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, conference organizer, and author. He's a regular guest on radio shows around the world, and he has been, and sounds like he will be again, a radio show host. He was executive assistant to the late UFO abduction researcher Bud Hopkins, and his articles, columns, essays, and commentaries have appeared online and in numerous print publications both here and abroad. He's appeared as a guest on and been a consultant to numerous television programs and documentaries. He's also co-author of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up, and investigation. Peter Robbins, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to be back with you.
I thought today maybe we could talk about something maybe a little off the beaten path, but something that I've been thinking about a lot and reading across the internet. A lot of people interested in the UFO phenomenon, interested in ufology and its future. I've seen some speculation about this. I want to get your take on it because I think you have an interesting perch from which to comment. And that's about the future of ufology. And I will start out with a little anecdote. I'm not going to say the group. But a couple of years back, I recall going to a local group of people who are very interested in UFOs. Seem like very nice people, smart people, intelligent people. At the time, I was 43 years old, and this is not meant as not to be flip or as an insult. I was 43 years old. I probably brought down the average age of that audience by 20 years. And I'm not particularly young. I'm a middle-aged guy. And it got me to thinking, and since then I've seen a lot on the internet about the future of ufology. Is it simply those of us 40 plus who are interested in this anymore? And is it something that will go on as we kind of pass off the scene? What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, first, I think you've chosen a terribly important and often neglected topic. And for the moment, let's talk about this question as it applies to the serious interest in study and advancing the work in the Western world. Here in America, our counterparts in the UK and across Europe, because I think there's a different phenomena going on in other parts of the world, which is very gratifying, but which in great part doesn't bleed through here. I know that when I got involved in the subject, it was a very non-standard way, and it happened, to say overnight would be an exaggeration. It happened in a matter of a minute or two. And that was not so much with a profound childhood sighting that I had with my sister Helen. It had to do with the return of the memory of that sighting 14 years after the fact. It was so not even traumatic to me as an adolescent, but I guess in looking back on it, I innately understood that there was ridicule attached to this topic. Growing up in a small village not far from New York City in the 1960s, I had no interest in the subject, less than no interest. I don't think it ever really occurred to me, except in the entertaining black and white B-movies that I'd see sometimes on a Saturday afternoon at the Fantasy Theater in Rockville Center, Long Island. But there was this understanding that I guess bled through to me somehow that UFOs were real in those movies. Otherwise, the adult world really dismissed them. And coming into this awareness at that age, like most adolescents, I just wanted to be liked. I wanted some cooler clothes, a girlfriend, to not be the nerdy little kid that I was. And so I did find a way to repress that memory. Of course, not understanding, having heard the phrase repressed memory, I don't think it existed at the time. But when that memory came back in my late 20s, it came roaring back. And attached to it, after discussing the memory with my sister, who confirmed it in detail, was her memories of archetypical abduction-related memories, things I've heard hundreds of times now that I had never heard before that moment. So I was thrust into it in a non-standard way. However, to the point, we now live in a time where, with the internet, with this age of conspiracy that we live in, more and more, every younger person, sooner or later, in adolescence, in middle school, in high school, is going to start to be exposed to this reality here in the United States, that we're a very divided country, that the lack of trust in government grows as general acceptance of what we would have in the past considered very extreme possibilities grows as well. Even the most conservative thinking, grounded person is willing to accept that our government lies to us, that extraordinary things have happened, that things are covered up. And I think the UFO subject is emblematic of that. But take, I don't know, it's not fair to make a generalization across an age line, but I know an awful lot of 20 and 30 somethings who are bright, who are articulate, well-educated, making their way out in the world, who it's just a matter of understanding that, of course, some UFOs are real and that they represent technology, intelligence far in advance of ours from other places, if nothing else. For me, when I started my study of this, if you want to call it that, my path in this area of learning, I went through several points in my growing awareness where I was in absolute shock that some of these things might be, and resisted in to varying degrees accepting them until I had really had a chance to learn more about them, to see the best evidence that I could, to have time to adjust to the possibility, where everything is so instant now, and you can't literally go online without being bombarded by information of a somewhat controversial nature. And let's remember that the first two major subjects to establish themselves on the internet were pornography websites and UFO-related websites. It's ironic, but it's true. I think there's also now a phenomena where so many people, and it's all of us if we open ourselves up to it, but certainly younger Americans are so bombarded with information and input and popular culture and turns in history and overreactions that to choose a path to become a professional or a passionate student of a subject that still has a ridicule factor to it, that still has a real nerd factor to it, maybe better to just keep my ears open and to, look at it as one of many interesting subjects out there. But the fact is, the generation before us, the ones that were really at it, you know, in the 60s, the 70s, they were real pioneers overall. They were explorers. They were looking into this thing from many angles. They were cutting new territory. That territory is cut now, Jim. And we've kind of hit a wall of information. You know, one can become a very vocal participant of the disclosure movement. And that's great. I think it's helping to educate people in increasing amounts around the world, but it's expanding expanding arithmetically. It's not expanding geometrically until we have mass landings or some series of events that completely transform, you know, humanity's perception of this. the subject is going to advance 1, 2, 7 people at a time. How do we bring younger people into this work to pick up where a lot of us will be leaving off whenever it is that we move on allegorically or actually? I'm not sure the answer to that.
One question that comes to mind now, certainly I don't want to minimize in any way historic UFO sightings, Roswell, Rendlesham Forest, Shag Harbor, whatever it may be. All of these are very important, just like in just plain old history. You know, the FDR administration was hugely important in world history and American history. Yeah. But there have been many administrations after that also that are subjecting, including recent ones, that are very important in their own way to world history. But when we look at a lot of the big UFO sightings that books and films are made about and researchers have done on, now, you know, you're talking about Rendlesham being one of the more recent ones that come to my mind as one of the biggies, and that's 35 years ago. So my question, and again, where are the big current sightings? Is government just doing a better job of covering things up? Has there been a change in the level of act? Assuming that there is something going on, which I believe there is, have whatever is behind it, have they changed their activity level? Why don't we see these watershed cases like a Roswell, like a Rendlesham, like a Shag Harbor? Why don't we see as many of those in the 90s and the 2000s and the 10s, I guess we call them? Why don't we see more of them now?
Great question, Jim. And it's probably a combination of factors that account for it. It may well be that there has not been a major incident in the last 10 or 20 years or so with the depth, the potential impact, the real potential to mine scientific, historical, and other kinds of evidence from it that one can make a fair presentation with at the level of a Rendlesham or a Roswell or some of the other cases that you mentioned. Also, it's not out of the question that we're all kind of on overload from it. And part of the problem of the internet, because it's such a double-edged sword, it gives you immediate access to everything. However, to separate the wheat from the chaff, you know, here's a great photo of something alleging to be an anomalous UFO. Here's film footage. Here's another account of somebody that has penetrated into some above top secret circle. You've either got to take their word for it or do your own photographic or film analysis, or at the same time, in some other way, find a way to make a deduction that is more than hope, speculation, or longing. There's another factor too here, and it's one that a lot of people in the field, I think, are not comfortable about, and it has to do with the nature of ufology itself. If you want to think about that first generation of combination, courageous, naive, passionate, brave, misled individuals that came out of the late 40s, the 50s, who began to really do the work. And I'd say, you know, nobody more than, say, retired Major Donald Kehoe, as you know, a former Marine fighter pilot in World War II, decorated, who is really, more than I think any other individual, the father of modern scientific UFO studies. We're now, let's say, four generations or three generations or however long you want to measure a generation into this. And we have a current group of people who are known to varying degrees in the work. Let's just say hypothetically that there are 100 of them worldwide. And at the top right now of the living ones might be, say, Stanton Friedman, sure, who is 80 years old, been doing the work for, gosh, you know, 50 years or whatever, is kind of an elder statesman of the subject. And at the entry level, let's say you have somebody who is starting to get known, who is beginning to publish their work, who is, earnestly for themselves trying to sort it out, doing radio shows, occasionally getting their name known. And then you have everybody in between. And, you know, without any problem, you and I can think of a slew of them, many of them Americans, some of them British, a few names that come up internationally. For better or for worse, we have a situation here where, like our elected politicians in this country, you get to a point where you, let's say, have the equivalent of tenure. You are acknowledged as a player. You're a known commodity in the work. You're associated with one, or in usual cases, more than one area of specialty research. Unfortunately, human nature enters into this here, and a certain kind of stasis. You may see yourself as having an area of territory to protect, or you feel that you've got to come up with new stuff on a semi-regular basis to ensure that you get hired to speak at conferences, that your next book will be read, well read, that radio hosts like you are going to contact you and invite you on their shows to promote what you're doing. In so doing, a mechanism goes into place. And again, this is human nature. And the best allegory I can find is contemporary politics, where at a certain point, and I don't think there's malice aforethought, I think it's kind of a natural process that a lot of us may miss when it's happening. You realize you're in business. You're a ufologist. You're doing your best to keep your name known, your head above water, your audience growing, you know, your website looking sharp, what have you. And in the process, you may be losing your courage to put yourself and your reputation on the line. You're more interested in being liked than doing the best, most controversial work that you can. You don't want to push the envelope too hard or too far, but you know you have to maintain that appearance of doing so. I'm guilty in a way of violating one of the basic precepts that are understood in the work of thou shalt not speak poorly of thy fellow person in the field in a public forum because of the way that you're going to be perceived. Namely, the outside world is looking to take us down. We're small enough, isolated enough, specialty interest group that a lot of people think of as kooky or weird or strange to start with. So who needs any infighting made public? You know, you have dirty laundry, you do it in private. However, when I started in this work, again, almost 40 years ago, I made a really simple series of promises to myself. I haven't been perfect, but I've done my best, which is if you're going to research something, go into it without agenda. Follow that evidence wherever it goes, even if it's a place that you wish it didn't go. Then do your best to publish it or relate it in the most honest, straightforward manner that you can. That can be a problem for some folks. And for me, I look at myself right now and I realize, gosh, over the last year, I think a number of people have gone from seeing me as a likable person in the field who has done good work, who's straight up, who is, a person worthy of respect, to somebody who's something of a troublemaker and, you know, maybe best to be approached carefully or at a distance. I'm off on a tangent here, but I think part of the problem about where we go from here or how do we enroll a new generation of folks, that's part of the problem. One of the things that I don't see is hardly any effort on the part of the ufological community to enroll a next generation of people. But how do you get somebody to become passionately interested in a subject? In our case, it usually is not going to happen intellectually. Although, for an open mind, I think many of the best people in the field have always been those who have not had UFO sightings or events or abductions. They simply are smart and interested and know that a certain amount of the data of what's officially put forward about the UFO phenomena, which is bunk, doesn't correlate with the true scientific stats that we have at hand. I would like to see a major effort on brainstorming this problem with people in MUFON, which I don't know, they have X number of thousands of members. It's an American organization, but they have members around the world. It's the world's largest organization studying and, you know, associating itself with UFOs. But we're a tiny, 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 tiny group. And I say we, because I am currently a member. I'm not always, sometimes gone for years without being a member. Part of it is, I forget. Part of it is moodiness. Part of it is how I'm feeling at that moment about the work in general, about being as fiercely independent as I can. But as a dialogue that is equally important as doing the work is how do you create a climate that is more welcoming to a new generation of students of the subject and one that can compete with the world of new technological devices, of fighting like hell to make a living in an increasingly problematic economic world that competes with the incredibly shifting, almost mercurial political situation, which has everybody on edge with the world of what's going to happen next in the world of international terrorism, in the world of divide and conquer us by the us and them mentality. They're different, kill them all and let God sort it out. You know, I'm not trying to be flip here or go too far off on a tangent, but we have our work cut out for us in order to make this subject one that more people will want to pick up and move forward with where we leave off. And again, how much further can we collectively in the community of people that have had these experiences, that have lived them, that have witnessed them, that have had the courage to come forward, as well as the people that do this, what I'll laughingly call professionally, because it's not a great profession to be in to make a living. God knows.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've seen your presentations both in person and via the web when you were kind enough to do one of our Plus Club seminars. And great documentation and so forth. But sometimes, and this could extend to younger people or people of any age, you're showing these incredible documents, highly, you know, highly sourced and so forth, and these kind of bombshell documents. And people say, oh, that's interesting. And you kind of think, my God, man, what's wrong with you? Let me take you by the lapel and shake you. Don't you realize what this is? Does that ever happen to you?
You know, it's funny that you say it like that. When in the first few years of my becoming involved in this work, and I certainly didn't publish anything for the first few years, I think my first article was published about 3 years or so after I got involved. But once this memory returned, and it was a clear multiple UFO daylight sighting, disc-shaped objects, metallic, in a V formation, corroborated by my sister. And I should say here for anybody that's thinking to themselves, well, Peter gets in touch with his sister and says, do you remember such and such? And she says, yes. I was careful not to do that. I called my sister that afternoon and said, I've remembered something important from childhood, and I need to know what you remember about the same event. And I'm concerned that if I tell you what I remember, you'll say yes or no, but I'll never know for sure in my heart whether you remember the details. And so what I did, which is not a bad way to proceed in such cases, was to set the scene, the weather, the time of day, where we were standing, stuff like that. And she jumped in mid-sentence and filled it in. And the shock to me was like a split. If you can say one thing in two ways at the same time, in my head, I guess my basic reaction was, oh my God, they're real. And oh my God, they're real. One concern, one, you know, that feeling of affirmation that you weren't alone and that your memory matches somebody else's memory. But there were times in those early first year, I'll say, and I remember it best coming or going from my alma mater, where I was on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts. Our main building was on East 23rd Street. I swear to God, I would catch myself occasionally walking down the street, looking at people's faces and thinking, you're all sleepwalkers. You have no idea what's going on. The world is so much different than you think. And, you know, you're concerned with the decent, regular, everyday, mundane things. And then I'd have a moment where I'd visualize Kevin McCarthy at the end of the Body Snatchers standing in the highway screaming, they're here. They're here already. You're next. You're next. And I'm not kidding. At a certain point, if you can't catch yourself at moments like that and have a little fun at your own expense and just lighten the hell up, because you're not going to change it, the best you can do is the best you can do. And occasionally, I don't have that kind of dramatic feeling. But if anything, one thing that years in this work has given me is a deeper appreciation for the depths of people's anxiety around subjects that are so difficult to accept, either because of the way that you were brought up, either because of religious or secular beliefs that you hold dear, or because one of Stanton Friedman's great mantras, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's already made up. A skeptic is, I think people misunderstand that term sometimes as it's associated with the subject of UFOs. Everybody, the best people in the field are skeptics. They have to be. Somebody like me, it's been years, decades maybe, since I have had what I would call the luxury of disbelief. I have seen a preponderance of overwhelming evidence that you could take to court that establishes for me, if nothing else, Jim, that we are not alone. There are other intelligences. Who knows where they come from? Yes, probably some of them are extraterrestrial. Yes, interdimensional. Why not? It's very difficult to disprove somebody else's theory, although I think some are more tenable than others. And at the same time, I guess as a humanist, I know that it's more important to me on a day-to-day basis as an investigative writer specializing in the subject of UFOs, how this is impacting on people who have been abducted, people who have had contact experiences, people who are, you know, overwhelmed by the love that they feel from these other intelligences, people who live in abject fear that they're going to be taken out of their room again in the middle of the night, and that if anybody finds out about it, they'll be doubly damned. As Bud used to sometimes say, making fun of somebody who comes forward, has the courage to come forward and say, this happened to me, is like making fun of a rape victim for being raped because you don't believe rape happens. So I don't get that frustrated that often. I try to be compassionate. I try to be understanding. I have a very long fuse, which occasionally does burn down to the end, and then I go off. But never, and I'm saying this not to you so much to your audience, never confuse the term a skeptic, because you've got to be a skeptic in this work, with debunker. Right. There is an abject arrogance and a nastiness to people who come from the point of view that, in the way I would say it, is it can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else.
Right. And exactly. Exactly. That's my biggest pet peeve.
And explain to your poor little believing self who wants so much, you know, for ET to come and visit you. There is a condescension. There is a sarcasm. There's a mocking quality that I find absolutely abhorrent. Those people are not worth our respect. And as, again, Bud, who had such a great grasp of this subject and who also had a very dry sense of humor, I remember once when we were working in the office and the subject came up, He said, you know, we're doing our best to try to understand an overwhelming mystery. They're the true believers. They know it's not going on. You know, you got to envy them. How wonderful is that?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my pet peeves is, you know, any, and this could be about anything Fortean, but particularly UFO phenomena, there'll be a story that there was thus and so sighting. And then there'll be this paragraph. According to researcher Ben Radford, fill in the name, whoever it might be, many times this phenomenon is mistaken for whatever it is, swamp gas or whatever, without specifically addressing the merits of the case in question, but just making a blanket statement about what this person could be imagining or seeing or whatever. And then the media says, oh, it's solved. Everything is solved because this, and as you say, not skeptic, but debunker, said that, it must be their imagination or swamp gas or, you know, Venus or fill in the blank. That it's solved just by making a blanket statement, a blanket debunking statement, without specifically addressing the merits of the case in question.
Bingo. Well said. And that is one of the reasons why, especially if you are experienced in the work, especially if you are known, you know, because this is what you do, never, ever take anything for granted. Or let's say you've hit that point that I discussed where you no longer have the luxury of disbelief. Begin at the baseline again. Begin as though it's your first case. Begin as though you don't believe in it. When I was, I guess, about 11 or 12 years old, I read my first Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes novel, and I was introduced to it, like a lot of younger people were at that time, because I had seen some of the terrific late 30s, early to mid 40s Sherlock Holmes movies starring the indomitable Basil Rathbone and his wonderful Dr. Watson, played by the great Nigel Bruce. And one of the things I loved about Conan Doyle's character was he ascribed to Holmes something he called deductive reasoning. And part of the way that functioned was, if you're looking into a mystery, you begin by not cutting to the chase. You begin by investigating it as fully and completely as possible from the most mundane, everyday, boring point of view. If you are unable to find an acceptable solution based on that, you take one step up and reinvestigate it as a slightly more exotic mystery. If you keep going and you've given everything you can to looking at it from every possible way and trying to resolve it or solve it in conventional terms, and you're unable to, that's when you begin to investigate it as something anomalous or extraordinary. And often that's where it really gets exciting in the work. However, it's boring. It's repetitive. It's not sexy. It's not romantic. It's not, you know, seeing yourself as some kind of latter-day secret agent in your mind, some kind of, you know, Walter Mitty construct. And I think sometimes people in the work, because they know the phenomena is real, whatever the hell it represents or the different things that it represents. I have no doubt that we're not dealing with one kind of anomalous phenomena here. It's just, well, everybody knows it's real. So why not just go for looking at it as, you know, another ship from Alpha Centauri, or it's something else that, you know, comes out of my understanding of MJ-12 or. It's a much more plodding, workmanlike way to proceed, but I think it's an important way to proceed.
You kind of touched on it earlier in that answer as well, and I'm going to throw this out there. You know, when I was first interested in this, going back to when I was a kid and watching In Search Of in the 70s, and now, you know, going into my 10th year of podcasting, which seems kind of strange, Originally, I started out with the thought, and maybe this is not fair to him, but I kind of think of it as the Stanton Friedman model. Basically, what we're seeing here is maybe like kind of an ET NASA, that these creatures or whatever it might be are sending probes here to investigate, whether it's a general survey or down to actual abduction. And that's what is the phenomenon that can't be explained by things like weather or, you know, secret government aircraft and those kind of things. But there's a certain percentage that is ET basically sending down either a landing party or just kind of an exploration. That was kind of my thought process. The more I talk to people, things like other dimensional travelers, maybe there's a trickster element to all this, kind of broadening what UFOs might be. For example, I had Whitley Strieber on a few months back, and he said, you know, he thought that, and I'm not quite sure what he meant by this, but the visitors had something to do with what we call death, you know, really kind of a mind bender, there. Maybe I should have followed up more, but I'm not quite sure what he meant by that statement. But my point is that it almost becomes like a funhouse the more you look into this, and it's confusing and it's mind bending, and, you know, it doesn't make logical sense sometimes. And then different people see different things. Some people see the gray, some people, you know, see the blonde haired, blue eyed, and maybe there's a shape shifting component, kind of like an Alice in Wonderland kind of thing down the rabbit hole. What are your thoughts on that? Do you still subscribe, or maybe you never did, to the kind of the, I hate to say this, but simplistic view that this is basically an ET NASA? Or do you think, and it sounds like you may, based on your previous answers, that this is a far more sophisticated and strange phenomenon than we previously had thought?
Well, I know my thought processes began very much akin to yours. My three mentors in the work, and boy, was I lucky to have these people in my life within a relatively short time. The first few years that I began my own exploration, one was Bud, who was self-trained as a investigative writer and was a brilliant one. Had Bud gone into police work, God help the criminals of the world. He was a detective, a brilliant articulator of the evidence that he brought forward. But, and is one of the things I related to him, was always very proud about, that I was a painter too. And when you are trained to be an artist, you are literally trained to think out of the box and solve and come at problems in non-standard ways, often with options for solutions that one would not think of in the workaday world. My other two mentors, one was a retired staff officer of the Hungarian army during World War II, who was in charge of all photo reconnaissance and photo analysis for the Hungarian military during the war. And he approached it, as he called it, as a matter of military science. The third one, oh, what a great guy he was, Detective Sergeant Pete Mazzola, a bigger-than-life, no-nonsense, tough, Italian-American, Catholic, Brooklyn, New York City police detective. And the main thing I learned from Pete was, you investigate these things in the same manner that law enforcement people investigate putting together a crime, or that a good criminal attorney will build a case. You triangulate, you find and you document and you confirm actual real types of evidence, physical evidence, anecdotal evidence, visual evidence, photographic, personal testimony and witness, historic evidence, etc., and triangulate each one supporting the next. You know, Rendlesham, for example, is a case you could, if our courts of law adjudicated such things, that you could bring to court and that you could win. Of course, that ain't going to ever happen. But as I became more involved in the work, and as my own anxiety of seeing it in this very tight frame, very workmanlike, began to allow itself to be open and read other people, I think an influence on a lot of very pragmatic researchers whose minds have opened on other possibilities has been the great pioneering work of Jacques Vallée. What Whitley says about maybe having something to do with death sounds very poetic to me. I don't know or understand what he's talking about there, but I am a very nuts and bolts person. I get no channeled messages from people in outer space. I have no contacts within the Pentagon or the NSA. I don't get, I do my best with what I can find and what I have. And I've been very fortunate over the decades in making contact or people making contact with me with far more impressive credentials than I could ever dream of having, certainly in military and intelligence in terms of their backgrounds. And my greatest teachers in this have not necessarily been my fellow ufologists. It's been people that have had the experiences, starting with my sister, whose 15th anniversary of her death I'm going to be marking along with my family this coming Saturday. Helen was ferociously courageous about never backing down from what she remembered. And for me, when she first talked to me about this almost 40 years ago, I didn't know what to make of it. It was very intimidating, upsetting to me. What happened to my sister? And is my sister got both feet on the ground here? I would say now conservatively, especially through the years I was privileged to work with Bud, but certainly on my own as well, I have heard people give me accounts and partial memories of their experiences that in some cases reflect her precise memories or things that she remembers hearing in her head during abduction experiences. There is a standard thing going on here. And I do believe as the years have shifted, more open, honest people who are willing to challenge their own beliefs whenever a viable challenge comes up and have grown from it. Years ago, in like the early to mid 70s, when the investigation of this, what we now would call the UFO abduction phenomena, was in its infancy, the great majority of people in the work kept away from it as far as they could. As Dave Jacobs once said very dryly years ago, you know, we were consumed with lights in the night sky or with the number on the license plate rather than who the driver was and what they were doing. Then there was the euphemism of they were experimenting, you know, and you see an alien in my mind in a laboratory with test tubes,
right,
a human being on the table. I think experimenting was always the wrong term. There was a program in effect, and they were just following through on it, at least the ones who were. Then you've got people who would say, well, here's another very important thing. I have always tried to be really careful to separate what I know as empirical fact, which is damn little in this work, and could prove in a court of law, from what I am passionately believed to be true, but can't prove, from what I think may be true, but may not be true, from what I fear may be true, but I hope isn't. I know people, we all do in the field, who what they put forward as fact, and again, how can you disprove them in a way, is really a lightly veiled version of their hopes, their longings, their beliefs, their fields, or their agenda. The worst offenders for me are people who will make blanket statements like there are, you know, 154 alien races visiting the Earth. Now, that kind of statement makes me crazy. There's a wonderful quote that's ascribed to Hermann Goering, Reich Minister of Culture, which I was always kind of entertained by, although I'd hardly call Goering an entertaining figure. And it translates from the German as, when I hear the word culture, I reach for my pistol. Well, when I hear somebody say they ascribe a number in a case like this, I reach for my keyboard, and God help them. This is a crazy thing to put forward. And then other ones will actually say all those negative alien experiences, the ones that are overwhelmingly reported by people like Bud Hopkins, where people are traumatized or upset or feel like outsiders or have post-traumatic stress, those are actually military abductions. How do I know that? Well, because all aliens are good and they would never do anything like this. And I'm not joking. There are people who put.
Oh, yes. Oh, I've interviewed them. I've interviewed them.
It's enraging. If you hypothetically, Jim, had the distinction of a few years from now, through circumstances beyond our imaginings, found yourself to be director of the NSA, president of the United States, the Queen of England, the Prime Minister of England, President Putin, and the supreme leaders of six alien races, there'd still be no way you could corroborate such absolutely blatantly, unfathomably uncorroborable allegations. It just can't be done. And let's face it, in ufology, we don't have the equivalent of, say, an American Psychiatric Association for psychiatrists or an AMA, problematic as that can be for some of us, for physicians looking over us. If we step over the line in terms of our, you know, Hippocratic oath that we will lose our license to practice medicine. In fact, as I best understand it, in order to become somebody who can call themselves a credentialed ufologist, I believe the procedure is you touch your finger to your nose, you turn around three times and you say, I'm a ufologist, and you can hang out your shingle. Who's going to say no? And if you haven't published anything, well, you're a new ufologist. But, and I'm only half joking here.
Right.
We don't have any overriding guidance. And every individual in the work, from the best known to the least known, is only as good as their work proves them to be, and only as worthy of our respect as their personal ethics code that, you know, will either unwind or will prove them to be somebody who did their best work, kept their word, always had an open mind, was willing to be corrected or correct themselves rather than take, kind of the Dick Cheney, George Bush, tough guy. I regret nothing. I make no mistakes. If I did make a mistake, I'm never going to admit it. And, you know, I'll tough it out. That macho ethic should have no place in this work.
Now, and I hadn't planned on asking this, but it did come up in my mind as you were mentioning about people who claim, you know, there's 57 alien races, this real kind of out there information. Do you think at least some of that, and I'm not asking for a yes or no, but do you think it's possible that some of these people are planted to make all people interested in UFOs and the study of them look like a bunch of kooks?
I think those people probably have existed and to a small degree do exist. However, I think we have a much higher predominance of what I would call useful idiots who do the work of the government masters, so to say, willingly, because they've self-assigned themselves the job. They see it as a noble undertaking. They don't bother me with the facts. I've already made up my mind. Anybody who takes UFOs seriously is at best dysfunctional and naive. At worst, you know, somebody who really is a terrible mischief maker and is screwing around with our known scientific way of seeing the world, and they should be exposed for the charlatans they are. I think, yes, of course, they exist, but I think that much more often it may be somebody we may perceive doing that, but they're just doing it because that's the way they are, and that's the role they assigned themselves. But, oh, yes, I think both possibilities are very real.
You've been very generous with your time. I just have a couple more things for you. One about some newer sightings, and then also we want to find out things that you're up to, because we had spoken to some length about some of the conferences you've started up and some of the things you're doing. Quite exciting. In my line of questioning, the final thing I have for you is, what are some of the, quote, better, newer UFO sightings or experiences? What are some of the things that may one day line up with a Rendlesham or a Roswell, or even not to that level, but things that you think are notable in the last several years, or are there any?
Yes, there are. And I should jump in here and say first, Jim, that at the beginning of the show, I said, let's focus here on the Western world, the United States, the UK, Europe. Over Thanksgiving, myself, Richard Dolan, and Robert Salas, two of my closest colleagues and best friends in the world, had the honor of speaking at the World UFO Congress in southern Brazil, organized by my friend and colleague A.J. Javard, probably the best known and most respected ufologist in South America. And I say South America to distinguish him from Jaime Maison, who for many people is a well-known individual in the field, but he is that person in Central America. And the conference that we spoke at drew, I'd say, between 300 and 350 people. The audience was equally men and women, and ranged in age from certainly the 70s down to adolescence. And it was a very different kind of group dynamic than the ones I have seen in the States to a degree, that younger people, they were out there. They were interested. They were networking with older senior people in the work. This was a window in for me on a culture that I've never experienced. And I love the time that I spent in Brazil and would go back there in a second. I think it's a wonderful culture, and the people were as dear as any people I've met anywhere. But it gave me hope that, and I know in South America and Central America, the subject at hand is accepted much more readily by the quote-unquote establishment. Let's remember that those famous Trinidad, 1957 Trinidad Island UFO photographs taken from a Brazilian battle cruiser, a warship, with 800 witnesses in terms of the sailors on board, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer as part of the International Geophysical Year, snapping this brief but remarkable series of certainly some of the finest UFO photographs we've ever had at our disposal, and ones that are 100% real. And when I say real, I mean, we don't know what it is, but we do know that it was a fully articulated disc-shaped object, carefully and well photographed in daylight, of a certain appreciable size, traveling, you know, in this area. Also, one thing that many of my American colleagues and I are only beginning to become aware of over the past few years is the explosion of serious scientific interest in the subject of UFOs in all places, China, where there are hundreds and hundreds of UFO clubs. And often there is a criteria for membership. You have to be at least an engineer. This is not, you know, taken lightly by the Chinese, who in no way mystify the subject. You know, these folks are brought up in a shifting, but certainly still scientific, socialist, communist background. And now it would be a year and a half ago, Stephen Bassett's extraordinary event in Washington in May of 2013, the citizens' hearings on UFOs, one of the most respected voices in Chinese ufology, and I'm forgetting his name, but he is a PhD, and I did have the honor of meeting him, and a colleague of mine, and stayed in correspondence with him. He said he estimates that there are at least 10 million Chinese who are passionately interested in this subject. Now, in a country with such an appreciable population, that 10 million is not an awful lot of people. It's still an awful lot of people from where I sit. I think that maybe it will happen that a decade or so from now, where, you know, the auto industry, let's say in the United States in 1960, compared to the auto industry in Japan or Korea in 2015, you know, manufacturing focus has shifted to another part of the world. The hotbed, the cutting edge of ufology a generation from now may not be in America. It may ultimately become a much smaller area of study than it is now, and it sure ain't big now. But that it may well emerge in the third world more. A lot of interest in India as well. Central and South America and China may become the cultures that take us into the future on this subject. We don't know. I did digress, though, and you wanted to know a little bit about what's been going on with me and what I'm looking forward to this year.
Sure.
I certainly intend to have a new book out by the end of this year, and I think the less said about it right now, the better. But it will be a combination of research, papers, anecdotes, stories, all relating to my involvement in the field, things that have happened to me, people that I've met in my work here. I couldn't even tell you how this actually transpired. I think it began a dozen or so years ago, working as an early kind of organizer and proselytizer from the fascinating, unique, and very enjoyable schizophrenic event that is the McMinnville, Oregon, UFO festival and conference. This small town in Oregon, where several very famous photographs were taken in May of 1950 by a farmer and his wife, last name Trent, has resulted in a growing yearly terrific event that is able to do something that I would have thought would not have been successful, which is have an awful lot of fun with the subject of UFOs. And when I say fun, I mean a huge parade, costume contests, all kinds of themed goofy, you know, toys and nonsense, but never mean-spirited or mocking, kind of a celebration of UFOs as they've emerged in popular culture, side by side with a terrific, if rather smaller, conference every year. And again, each year it grows. I encourage anyone, especially any of our friends in the Northwest, to get there this May. It's always fascinating and, again, a lot of fun. McMinnville is about an hour's drive from Portland. Then the years that I worked as an advisor and consultant to the city of Roswell, New Mexico, out of the mayor's office, and had the honor of being the liaison person back then with the any UFO-related matters relative to from the city of Roswell to the governor of New Mexico at the time, Richardson, they kind of made me realize that part of my value in the work was going to be assisting individuals and communities in creating worthy UFO-related events. And one thing led to another. And now I'm co-founder of the Exeter, New Hampshire UFO Conference. I'm co-founder of the Massachusetts UFO Conference that happens every October in, I think it's October, in Leominster, Massachusetts. I've worked from the beginning with the absolutely unique and terrific Experiencers Speak Conference, which turns the tables on every conventional UFO conference imaginable. It is the brainchild of a remarkable, smart, tough, good gal, Audrey Hewins, who also uses the name Audrey Starborn. Her sister, her family, her friends, who have all pitched in. And we're aiming for our fourth annual Experiencers Speak Conference coming up in late August in Portland, Maine. And where standard UFO conferences, you know, Jim, will have ideally better known and respected ufologists and people coming up in the work, and maybe a well-known person who has had experiences or is an abductee, somebody like Travis Walton or a Debbie Jordan, the subject of Bud Hopkins' book Intruders, or Linda Cortile, subject of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abductions. This conference has a few ufologists, and the whole rest of the weekend, it is abductees and experiencers that are the presenters. And it is a brilliant event. I also am very proud to have worked with Travis Walton for more than 3 years now on the original idea to develop something that we had our first one of early November, the first of what will be an annual conference in a fairly rural part of Arizona called the Skyfire UFO Congress. And Travis was able to surround himself with a terrific team of volunteers and organizers. And coming up this November will be the first weekend in November, or whatever is the closest time, to the 40th anniversary of Travis Walton's experience back in November 5th of 1975. This is an event that I'm very proud to be associated with also. So I'll be working those conferences as a speaker, MC for most of them. I'll also be appearing this year, this autumn, at the Paradigm UFO Conference. I'm hoping for the first time in 5 years to get back to Roswell this summer, although that's still up in the air. And a number of other interesting opportunities are shaping up for me. I've got a lot of writing ahead of me, and I'm starting to do more talks for local groups around the country via Skype. This past Saturday, I gave the first part of a two-part talk, which I'll complete next week, for a terrific local affiliate of MUFON in Huntsville, Alabama. And it was just, I would have much rather been there, but, you know, it's a fair amount of cash to bring in a speaker for a weekend rather than do a hookup on Skype and keep your costs as low as possible, coordinating there, showing my presentation image by image as I'm watching it on my second computer and telling them to advance as I continue the narrative of this story. I'm also available to, I try to keep in touch with anybody that really feels they need to speak with me, and am most available via my Facebook page should anybody want to contact me.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion on the future of ufology, some of the more recent cases, and everything you have going on, which it sounds like it's going to be quite an eventful 2015, and we'd like to thank you for spending a little bit of it with us today.
Jim, it's a pleasure. Always glad to return to your show anytime.
And thank you for tuning in. We certainly appreciate it, and I'm sure Peter would agree. Keep your eye to the sky. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.